Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. With Jeff Fawcett, PhD, we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. One of the problems with being human is incessant curiosity countered by a tendency toward hierarchy. What a mess. I have all these questions. Let's see. Does anyone know the answer? This becomes a problem because although we try to communicate with each other and we are mimetic and imitate each other, we actually are different. So it's generally more helpful to look at the complexities of who we are to find clues about what we need. What's true for me may not be for you. Problems abound when we bump up against greed and narcissism in the people we choose to trust and learn from. Boy, what an opportunity there is for this to happen when your health is in the mix. It's helpful to learn to think critically, to read the latest, newest study with an eye toward bias, and to remember that what's true for you changes depending on your circumstance. Okay, so when the media splashes around the newest recommendations on statin drugs as a fountain of youth, and immortality, what questions do you ask? What are we treating? Do we even know? Is there a reason why my body is doing what it's doing? Do we know if what my body is doing is wrong and on whose authority? Yes, it's scary when things inside your chest go thump, but what's going thump may not be treatable with a pill that changes the very adaptations your body is trying to make to keep you alive. Jeepers. And anyway, you are your body, darn it. Join us today as we look behind the curtain of industrial medicine to see if the people controlling the information are going to fly away in a balloon when things don't work out. Today we will smash the cholesterol myth of heart disease again. My guest today is Dr. Ernest N. Curtis, with a C. He received a BA in biological sciences from the University of California at Berkeley. He went on to receive his MD at University of California, Irvine, following a 3-year residency in internal medicine and a 2-year fellowship in cardiology. He entered private practice in Long Beach, California. Now semi-retired after 30 years in practice, he resides in North Tuscan, California. And we're very pleased to have you join us today, Dr. Curtis.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, you know, it was one of these moments where I had very much in mind to have somebody new to talk about this issue, and I found you, and you very graciously sent me a copy of your book, which is called The Cholesterol Delusion, and has a lovely picture on the front of a frying pan with bacon eyebrows, eyes made of egg yolks, a nose made out of a tomato, and a big sausage smile. It's very nice.
My wife gets the credit for picking that out.
It's quite lovely, yeah.
So,
you know, as luck would have it, we sign on to the New York Times to check the news headlines this morning, and there's this very helpful article about these newest recommendations that came out, and there's like a food fight going on over across the table among all these different organizations and doctors, and everybody's all heated and upset about various things. Rather than me do it, maybe you should explain what these new recommendations are, and then we can get into what's wrong with them.
Yes, the new recommendations have to do with trying to define who should be treated with statin drugs, being the ones that will lower the blood cholesterol level. The theory being that if you lower the cholesterol level, you lower the risk of disease and other complications of atherosclerosis. These recommendations come from so-called expert panels. We'll discuss somewhat the makeup of these panels because it's very interesting and bears a lot on the recommendations. But basically, I reject the entire treatment guideline that they put out, and for a couple of reasons. Number one, well, let me say this first of all. They say that they base the recommendation to treat people with statin drugs on a numerical risk factor calculation. And first of all, I don't think it's possible to quantify risk of heart attack with any degree of accuracy whatsoever. That's not my major argument, though. My major argument is that when one looks critically at the studies done with the statin drugs, they don't reduce risk, period.
We know, and we'll get into some of the other horrible things they do increase while they don't decrease risk. The thing that's interesting about this article in the New York Times today is the things that I highlighted in it is that they say right away, they say, these are guidelines to prevent heart attacks and strokes, which kill one out of every three Americans. Well, right off the bat, I think what we know is that statistics on what people die of are very slippery because the cause of death is they write heart disease or they write a heart attack when they don't actually know what the cause of death is. That's the sort of fallback. And in some countries like China, you know, you discuss in your book the fact that it's shameful to die of heart disease. So they won't write that down. So yeah. Well, the statistics are skewed. So how can you possibly say one out of three Americans is going to die of a heart attack or stroke?
You can't. and for the exactly for the reasons you laid out, what we use for statistics comes largely from death certificates. When a person dies, a death certificate has to be filled out. It's more of a legal document than a medical document. It was never really intended to provide accurate medical information. Rather, it was to ascertain that death did occur and allow the family to go ahead and bury the deceased, to probate the estate, and so forth. But the problem comes when the doctor has to fill in the cause of death. And if he doesn't fill in the cause of death, then the deceased becomes a coroner's case, gets into the bureaucracy, and it's kind of like sand in the gears, and nothing gets done for a while, and they can't bury the poor person who died or probate this estate or do any of these things. So in order to get around that, doctors in this country and others have, by convention, simply adopted what I call a default diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. No, it's extremely common.
Yes, oh. And you're absolutely right. And the studies that have been done on this have shown that the error rate in the diagnosis on the death certificate is often as high as 50%,
which
of course is huge.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable. The other thing that's ironic here is that some of the criticisms of the drafting committee is that they relied only on randomized controlled clinical trials, which is in fact the gold standard, but they ignored other strong data. They don't say what strong data, but the group was, they say this over and over and over again in this New York Times article this morning, that they were severely underfunded. They didn't have any money, and they ran out of money, and they didn't have money, and they didn't have money, and they were underfunded. It goes on and on.
I don't buy that.
Well, it's all very odd. You know, it's clear that certain interests weren't involved, or maybe they were. So the main problems here, and they're also disturbed because they came out with these guidelines and sort of just, you know, just sort of released them without any, as they say, public debate. And it's interesting because there's not usually any public debate when they make these recommendations anyway.
No,
so clearly this group is out of favor for some reason, but the main thing that's got the backup of these various cardiologists and heart specialists and professors and whatnot is that doctors are being told to stop their decades-long practice of monitoring levels of LDL. So the irony here is that part of the thing that's gobsmacking and disturbing about these new guidelines is that they keep driving down the levels of LDL, and they keep targeting LDL as this bad cholesterol. And I really defy anybody in our listening audience to survive a day without LDL cholesterol. It carries antioxidants through your body. It is there in balance with HDL. They work in conjunction with each other. And what your book, The Cholesterol Delusion, is about, and there are other good books by some of your friends and compatriots like Ufi Ravenskov's books, and Malcolm Kendrick, MD, the Brit who wrote The Great Cholesterol Con. And what you realize is that there's no way that cholesterol, and we'll go through this, there's no way that cholesterol is causing a problem. But they've targeted these LDL levels, and I have, even in my own practice consulting with people, have seen people whose cholesterol levels have been driven down to the fact where I fear for their immune function, for their hormone levels, their lungs can't work, their brains can't work. I mean, you can't really survive with that level of, this is like another, uncontrolled sort of non-consenting study on the public. What's going to happen when you drive people's cholesterol levels down to the levels that you see in cancer patients with advanced cancers?
That's a real good question, and of course we don't have any answers. We won't know what the long-term effects are until the long-term arrives. But the possibilities are a little frightening. As you pointed out, you can't live without cholesterol, and it's maybe the most important biochemical in our body in what it has to do to participate in the makeup of our cells, our hormones, etc. And to artificially suppress this with medication over many years' time, who knows what it may lead to?
Well, I think we have some ideas. I mean, Ufi, in his book, please, his book is, I've forgotten the actual name of it.
It's The Cholesterol Myth.
Myth. It's the myth. Myths,
yes.
With an S. With an S,
yes,
I think, plural.
Yes.
He points out that there... we're going to have to talk a bit about studies because you spend a lot of time talking about the problem with studies, but he cites studies that show that immune function plummets when cholesterol plummets. And in addition, as you point out, there are people who have over 1,000, whatever they're using, to PGML, or whatever measurement, a UG something, something, to measure. I mean, their measurement of cholesterol is like 400 to 1,000, and they never have an incident. So,
right.
So why don't you, if you will, give our listeners a brief lesson on what we think we know about what actually causes heart problems or heart attacks? Because that's part of the problem, is that there's an odd view.
Yes, and it's not the short answer, I guess, is we really don't know. What we're talking about when we talk about cholesterol is the development of atherosclerosis or arteriosclerosis, which is known as hardening of the arteries and develops gradually over time in everybody to one degree or another. So then the complications of atherosclerosis are said to be heart attack and stroke, and both of those come about when something causes a disruption of the lining of the artery. If it's in the coronary arteries to the heart, it'll cause a heart attack. If it's in the arteries to the brain, it can cause a stroke. But this triggers a blood clotting reaction, and it's the blood clot that cuts off the blood flow in a branch of a vessel, leads to the heart attack or the stroke. Atherosclerosis per se is probably related to it, but not to the absolute degree that most people think. There have been studies that show that where they've done angiograms on people both right before and after a heart attack, they've shown that a heart attack, blood clot has developed in an area where there was hardly any obstruction in the artery at all visible ahead of time. Only about a third of the heart attacks they looked at in that way occurred in the area where one would expect it to have been based upon the angiogram before the heart attack, for example.
Might mention here also, sorry to interrupt, that he's deceased now. He's quite elderly, but Dr. Howard Wayne, who described himself as a non-invasive cardiologist, who warned against these procedures like stenting and angiograms and plasties and even surgery, heart surgery, said that they often will actually burst a vein doing an angioplasty, or he does not suggest doing that because the body will naturally bypass a blockage on its own. And let me just say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone today with Dr. Ernest N. Curtis, MD. We're discussing his book, The Cholesterol Delusion, and the new recommendations on statin use. So, yeah, so he's saying the body will bypass on its own. You don't have to do that, and these angioplasties are dangerous.
Well, he makes some good points there, and I think that there might be some place for some of these procedures, but not nearly to the extent that they are done or have been done in the recent past.
And also, I think I've read probably either in Ufi's work, and when I've interviewed him, or possibly in Malcolm Kenrick as well, that when they have done autopsies on people who have died presumably of a heart attack or a stroke, that the plaques, in fact, are not primarily cholesterol at all. They're primarily inflammatory cells and red cell, you know, white cells, and sort of an inflamed reaction, more of inflammatory cells, not so much cholesterol.
Yeah, I mean, there's cholesterol present in the plaques, but that's a little bit deceptive. It's really an acute event that occurs when you have a heart attack or a stroke with the acute development of the blood clot. And as I said, it can occur in areas where the plaque is almost insignificant. There are also many, many instances of elderly people I've seen that have practically 100% occlusion of both carotid arteries going up to the brain and have never had a stroke or even a symptom of a warning sign for a stroke, for example. So there's no great one-to-one relationship there between the degree of arteriosclerosis and the occurrence of these things. We may be dealing with completely different phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
For example, we know that premature heart attacks, you know, defined as say before the age of 60, tend to run in families. Family history seems to be a fairly strong indicator there. So it brings the question to mind, what is it about these particular people that bring this about? Is there some inherent weakness in the endothelial cells that line the artery that makes it prone to disruption and development of the blood clot? Do they have some abnormality in the balance that we all have between our blood clotting factors and our anti-clotting factors? Nobody knows. They've been so hung up on cholesterol that nobody's really looked into this much.
I agree. People who like to test genetic variants, and I'm not a particular fan of that because I believe very strongly in epigenetics, which is that it may be that genetics loads the gun, but it's the environment that pulls the trigger. So it's prudent avoidance of inflammatory things, and not so much diet from what we've been seeing, but certainly pollutants and stress to some degree and various other things can increase your susceptibility. But it does appear that there are some genetic variants like lipoprotein A or
Apo protein.
So there are, you know, you might see that in a family line, but it doesn't mean that you can't intervene either with a good, strong heart protective nutrient program, exercise, you know, certain things like that. But I think the most important thing that should remain in people's minds as they listen to this is that scientists don't actually know what causes a heart attack. And in fact, Malcolm Kenrick brings up the possibility that it's not the ischemia from an occlusion that causes the heart attack either, that the timing on it is off for it to be the cause. So maybe the takeaway message is that we don't know and we're racing ahead and reducing a substance which appears in situations as a helper. So maybe it would be good for you to educate the listeners about what the benefits of cholesterol are and why it shows up sometimes in these events.
Well, as I stated before, cholesterol may be the most important biochemical in our body. Our body is basically being made up of trillions of cells, and there's a turnover of these cells constantly. Cells dying and being replaced, maybe 50 billion a day, estimated. Now, when you look at the cell, each cell is contained within a cell membrane, and that membrane, besides containing the contents of the cell, also governs everything that goes in or out of the cell. Controls what can get in, gets waste products out, and so forth. Within the cell itself, there are internal membranes similar to the cell membrane that surrounds it. The key point here is that all of these membranes are made up primarily of cholesterol and cholesterol-derived compounds. So anytime you have an injury, disruption anywhere, where the body needs to generate replacement cells, healing cells, and so forth, you would expect to need more cholesterol in order to do that. And cholesterol, in that sense, is certainly a help, and to suppress it may be, in fact, doing harm.
Well, it appears that if we look at the side effects of statin medications, which are pretty effective at lowering cholesterol, we see strokes, in some instances cancers, a lack of hormones, brain function plummets, the liver becomes damaged, there's muscle damage that leads to breakdown products that strain the kidneys from the extra protein, so the kidneys go south. And then there's, you know, these astonishing cognitive effects that people are reporting.
Definitely.
Your brain has all these lipoproteins in them. Your lung surfactant has lipoproteins.
Yeah, these cholesterol, are all cholesterol makes up the great majority of the brain and nervous tissue.
Mm, yeah.
It's especially important there. And, yes, you're right in pointing out all of these effects. Some can be lethal, some serious but not lethal, but an even greater number, people just feel lousy when they take them.
They do.
They have aches and muscle weaknesses and all kinds of things that are, you know, may sound a little vague, but gee, when they get off the drug, they always feel a heck of a lot better.
And to reiterate, there are statistics, and these do come from credible studies, that people who have extreme, in fact, there was a wonderful study that was done about predicting early morbidity in patients, in elderly patients, and they, I think it was like 5,400 or 54,000, it was a big cohort, and what they discovered was that the elderly people who had the highest cholesterol levels, unless their blood sugars were high, but those with normal blood sugars and the highest levels of cholesterol had the longest lives.
Uh-huh.
They had the lowest chance. Yeah. So the blood sugar issue does seem to have some effect on the fractionation of your cholesterol. So it could, you know, there's theories that maybe that's causing these little pieces not to get moved out when the cholesterol moves in and out. But, you know, that's, again, a theory that's not, we don't know that.
Yeah. And so, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, I would say so, too. So there's a lot of people with really high cholesterol that do just fine, thank you very much, that never have a problem. And in women, there's never been a connection between, well, it's there's not really any clear indication on either gender, but even more so in women. If women have a heart attack, it's for some other completely different reason. Now, you were talking about plaque, and if it's not cholesterol, what is it? And you use the term a fibrous cap, almost like a callus. So from that, I'm thinking that sometimes this could become more of a problem in people who have a tendency toward higher blood pressure. And I'm not recommending that people lower their blood pressure with drugs. What I'm saying is that, first of all, as you get older, it takes more blood pressure to circulate your blood. But the other thing is that there are exposures that cause people to get hyperaroused, that cause their blood pressure to go up. There are psychosocial stresses, pollutant stresses, lifestyle stresses that can also cause, it's amazing how much hypertension can be caused by that and by a lack of just moving around gently and taking breaks and stuff. But is that possibly one of the causes? Because atherosclerosis goes up in the, as we get older, no matter what, it goes up in all kinds of people.
Yes, and I don't pretend to know all the answers on that.
No,
I think the most sensible explanation been put forward is that it's really a protective effect that the body is trying to institute for the arteries at certain stress points. There are certain points in the arterial tree. You picture just a bunch of branches coming off from one another. Those branch points are where there is a lot of what they call shear stress on the wall of the artery, which is related to blood pressure. Many arteries have a curvature to them, and along the lesser curvature is a much greater shear stress on the wall than on the outer curvature. And in fact, that inner curvature is where we find these atherosclerotic changes, whereas the other side of the artery may be perfectly normal.
Yeah, you mentioned, yes, and you mentioned that it also seems somewhat predictable where there's going to be stress on the inner arterial wall.
Yes.
I mean, blood pressure goes up just based on what you're doing.
Yeah, and I'd sure like to underline the point you made about older people needing a little higher pressure, because I see one of the things I hated the most when I was in practice was seeing people overtreated for blood pressure, particularly elderly people.
Oh, they're exhausted.
Yeah,
when
absolutely.
You do that, their heart is slowed down. They can't move around. And that's, you know, counterintuitive, because you need to move around if your cholesterol is getting up. I mean, it can be gentle walking. It doesn't have to be anything that strains. In fact, it's better if it's gentle exercise to lower that.
Absolutely.
It's important to reiterate that we see what conventional medicine calls cardiovascular disease or heart attack in people with very low normal cholesterol.
Yes. Yes, this is one of the things that first got me interested in the whole thing back when I was way back when I was doing my cardiology fellowship, and I was seeing lots and lots of people with heart attacks. And I had been taught the party line, and saw no reason to doubt it at the time. But as I was seeing patients with heart attacks, it occurred to me that I was seeing the whole range. People with low cholesterol, mid cholesterol, high cholesterol, you name it. I didn't see any predilection. That's just my experience.
Well, but you practiced for a long time, so you saw a lot of patients. I think you can talk from that perspective.
Yeah, now I can now, but at that time I was kind of getting started, so I didn't know if what I was seeing was atypical or not. But then I started reading a lot and finding out that a lot of people were reporting large studies where the people with heart attacks had cholesterol that spanned the entire range of normal to abnormal, which, by the way, at that time, which we're talking here back in the mid-70s, normal cholesterol is considered to be between 150 and 350.
Right. And
that was the laboratory standard.
And you discuss this in the book. I also have a little piece of information on that, because I interviewed, when she was vital and easy to interview, a doctor who's, again, very elderly now, Dr. Mary Enick, who is a lipid researcher, a PhD, mm-hmm. who wrote almost intractable but very valuable book called Know Your Fats. And she was actually invited to some of the meetings where they were discussing this lowering of the allowable limit. And it was, of course, it was the drug companies were saying that if you let somebody, if you say the speed limit on the freeway is 55, people will drive 65. So if you tell them that they're allowed to have, you know, cholesterol of 300, they're going to have 400 or whatever, and it's irresponsible. So we have to lower it to 200, and then later it got lowered below that. So it's normal for somebody in their 60s to be 249, 300 is pretty normal.
Yeah.
It's
essentially normal to be whatever your genes have programmed.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. And maybe not only genes, but again, it's going to have something to do with the way you eat, even though low, not in the sense that you can raise your cholesterol by increasing your fat necessarily. There isn't a one-to-one ratio, but there is a ratio if your blood sugars are out of whack and if your, you know, other things are happening, you can have an effect on it. But it's usually not diet, and that's going to be the good news that we'll come back from after this little brief break I want to take for a moment here. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Jeff Fawcett standing by patiently, listening, and maybe he'll contribute at some point. And we are on the phone with a Dr. Ernest Curtis, his book, The Cholesterol Delusion. We're going to break briefly. Please stay with us for more conversations about the problems with statin drugs. Stay with us.
I've got you under my skin. I have got you. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me, and I've got you under my skin. I have tried so not to give in. I've said to myself, this affair, it never would go so well. But why should I try to resist when I know so well that I've got you?
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we're on the phone today with Ernest N. Curtis, MD, author of The Cholesterol Delusion. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our probably closer to 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Find out about our practice, a free stream of this week. Show our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please do that by email at admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Dr. Curtis, do you want to send anybody to any particular website or anything like that?
No, I don't have anything in particular in mind.
And you don't, you're not in practice anymore, so they should resist the temptation to call you or ask you for questions or whatever.
There are a few people who somehow give you mail address and send me questions, and I actually enjoy responding to them and communicating because you can only play so much tennis and golf to sort of time and gives me something to do.
Well, if somebody is creative enough to find to be able to find you, then you'll be able to answer an email. So now that lovely song by Diana Krall, "You've Got Me and I've Got You Under My Skin." Yes, it just came to me while I was writing the show. I went, "Oh my God, that's perfect." The important point here is that, oh God, I'm just remembering. I had this thing happen where people do know in the Bay Area who I am, and there was a very popular NPR panel show in the morning, and they had Dean Ornish on. And so I called in, and I said, people who aggressively lower their cholesterol, try to lower their cholesterol by using an extreme version of a vegan diet with 10% fat, end up with very high triglycerides and sometimes end up with diabetes. And here's why. And so they allowed Dr. Ornish to comment, and he referred to me as that person. So it's important to remember, I think, and probably encouraging for people to hear this time of year, that it doesn't matter what you do with your diet, because your body is going to make the cholesterol that it needs by, you know, it's going to do it whether you want it to or not. It's going to do it, you know. It's not going to be a direct relationship.
No, it has to. It's programmed to do that. We couldn't live otherwise.
So we know this how. We know that diet doesn't work how.
Diet doesn't work how to lower cholesterol.
Yeah, that it doesn't work to do that. How do we know that? Isn't it? I mean, what I'm sort of saddling up to is the idea that studies are a big problem. The way that conventional studies are designed, the things that are considered gold standards, the epidemiology studies, the epidemiologic studies, which you point out, epidemiologists were initially people who studied epidemics, and so everything turns into an epidemic, and they use correlative research, and you managed to come up with some correlative research that showed that if you drink more glasses of water, people are going to get very confused when I say that this is actually supposed to be an example to show you how ridiculous this is. It isn't a real suggestion, although you can do it if you like, but if you drink more water, you have less heart attacks. That's about how good the correlative research is into using statins to lower cholesterol and reducing heart disease risk.
Exactly right. And my point in the book in bringing that up was, I showed how the so-called improvement that people got by taking drugs to lower cholesterol was extremely small, on the order of generally 1 to 2%.
Yeah.
And then I pointed out that you can look at... they've done big meta-analysis studies on aspirin, you know, low-dose aspirin.
Aspirin,
therapy.
I think, does work slightly.
It gets about the same level of result.
Yeah, 1 to 2%.
Then I quoted this thing from the Adventist study about drinking extra water that showed a reduction in the untoward events like heart attacks that actually was better than with statin drugs. But then I said, does this mean that I'm advocating these as realistic treatments? And I said, absolutely not. I'm just showing that if you're going to claim significance for these teeny little differences in the statin studies, you have to explain why somebody shouldn't get the same result simply by taking a low-dose aspirin or drinking extra water.
It might be interesting also to wonder about studies which show the health effects of being poor, being socioeconomically disadvantaged, because it isn't always the case that people in underdeveloped, so-called underdeveloped countries, or people who are poor, always live less long. It's not clear. Sometimes it is clear, and sometimes it's also clear that because wealthy people have more interventions, that they actually sometimes...
Yeah, I'm sure that there's a lot of variability.
Yeah.
In general... And I think you can make a generalization to say that the people that live in poor socioeconomic circumstances don't do as well health-wise and longevity-wise as people who are better off, but there's certainly plenty of exceptions.
And you're not particularly fond of the stress theory of heart disease.
Well, I don't have any real theory of my own.
Other that's good,
what
I think.
About earlier,
I think that's good that you don't.
Well, yeah.
You don't have a dog in this fight.
No, I don't. And stress may certainly play a role, but the problem is how you quantify it. Stress is pretty subjective, and what you might feel is stress, I might not, or vice versa. There's a lot of the psychological element that comes into play there, so it's hard. It's very hard to pin down. It's very hard to do any really scientific studies with stress for that reason.
There is a cascade, of course, that happens when people are under chronic stress that isn't really designed to be optimal for anything, immune function, digestive function,
hormone function,
everything gets sort of tanked.
There's certainly hormonal changes mm-hmm. that take place.
Yep.
No question about that. But again, it's just difficult to quantitate it.
Yeah. So I know that you don't like the way most studies are designed. You caution people and coach people on how to look at studies. You talk about how the conclusions that the conclusions are sometimes backwards from what they... I've also noticed this and talked about it. So what can you conclude from studies?
about the causation of heart disease?
Well, since that's what we're talking about, but it would be a clue toward any study. How are they valuable? Because it would seem like we need to do something. What would be a better way to look at things?
Well, I would like to see us get totally out of this risk factor paradigm that seems to be dominant in research and looking at the causes of disease. It's really gotten us nowhere.
I agree.
And it's wasted untold billions of dollars and hours of time and so forth that probably could have been spent more fruitfully looking down other paths.
Well, it's made a lot of people very wealthy. Sorry, I keep dropping your book. If you heard a bang in the background, I keep pushing it off the table.
Well, it's not a very big book.
No, it shouldn't. But it is making a big noise, isn't it? But that's good. It's a good book. Talking about.
Yeah, actually, the part I enjoyed writing the most was that last section you referred to.
How to read studies.
How to read a medical study and how to interpret it. And the thing is, you have to ignore a lot of the boilerplate in there and the unsubstantiated claims that the people make and get right down to the raw numbers and look at them yourself. And you'll be amazed when you do this how often the margins they're talking about are so teeny and small that nobody with any common sense would give them any credence whatsoever. But they apply elaborate statistical manipulations to come out and say that something is quote statistically significant, where just on its face you would say, well, it's of no practical significance whatsoever.
Yeah, Jeffrey and I both use the word ecclesiastic concerning standard of care. I think there's a lot of fear. I think doctors are frightened of practicing in a way that will get them into trouble. If you would, I would like to hear more about how you practiced, given what you learned and what you saw in your practice, because I'm sure you treated elderly patients.
Well, yes, I spent a lot of my practice trying to get people off drugs they didn't need for various things,
mm-hmm.
And I made it a practice. I always recommended my patients don't take any of these cholesterol-lowering drugs. I recommend against them. Now, on one occasion, for certain that I can remember, and maybe another, I actually prescribed a statin drug. And the reason I did that is because after talking to the patient about it for quite a bit, they still wanted to take the drug. And I regarded my role as I was working for them. And I hold some radical position in some areas, and one of them is that I think any adult should be able to get any drug they want, anytime they want, without a prescription.
Well, you just made yourself very popular, I think, now.
I get your point. This way,
mm-hmm.
And so
if they're so dangerous, why are they out there?
You can consult a doctor for advice. Things that you should be able to go out and get anything you want.
In some countries,
so I told
you
my patients, If you ever want a drug for any reason, you know, feel free to ask me about it. I'll give you my advice on it. If you still want it, even if it's against my advice, I'll prescribe it for you because I think you should have the right to have access to that.
And you were not disbarred.
No. I mean, obviously, I had to temper that a bit in the sense that there are certain drugs that are required special triplicate prescriptions for
mm-hmm.
narcotics and
mm-hmm.
things that I could lose my license for if I gave those out willy-nilly. So
mm-hmm.
I had to temper it in that sense. But as far as the general run of drugs, no.
So what were you...
If they wanted to take an antibiotic and I thought it wouldn't help them, I'd tell them, and if they still wanted to take it, I'd prescribe it for them.
Dr. Dwayne Gravelein, who is the astronaut doctor who ended up having transient global amnesia from taking statins and went on a campaign and wrote lots of books, anti-statin books, said that he still, in certain cases, advocated, they usually give you a dose of maybe 20 to 40, usually 40 milligrams, and he was prescribing 5. And he said that at 5 milligrams, you can sometimes reduce the inflammation that may be contributing to this problem for people. It may reduce the inflammation, so he would
do
that.
Maybe, but I say but we why don't know. Stats to do it.
Yeah, you don't. You know, there's so many other things. There are nutrient things you can do to do that. There's
many
so
other
many.
Avenues.
Yeah.
Many other avenues.
So once again, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with Ernest and Curtis, MD. His book, The Cholesterol Delusion. We're talking about not using statins and not using drugs for the most part. Did you make dietary recommendations to your patients?
Usually no.
You didn't ask them to avoid fake fats and junk foods and things. You never saw any problem with that?
No, I basically told them to eat what they like.
Yeah.
The only dietary recommendations I made were for some people who had abnormal blood sugar reactions,
yes,
to follow something like the Atkins diet.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, the basically just a low-carb diet. There's lots of them out there now.
Mm-hmm.
But the Atkins diet was the first one that was really popular. And I found that people could lose weight on that and feel better. They just felt better.
I had the good fortune to interview him early in my career on the radio, unfortunately.
Dr. Atkins.
Yeah, he was very curmudgeonly, and then he got happy when he felt like he was being... But I think I... Not people
yeah, he
laugh.
Took a, he took a lot of static.
He was a cardiologist.
Yeah.
So... And,
he went against the Holy Grail. So
and
they really hammered him.
He did not die of heart disease. He fell. They gave him. He had an infection that went into his. He was older, and he had an infection
yeah,
that went into his heart.
Yeah, he fell and smacked his head. That's what
he bled out because they gave him blood thinners.
Yeah.
So, but he was very robust when I met him, and you know, his diet is basically a Paleolithic diet. I mean, it's the way that human beings ate for, I don't know, maybe 2 million years, hominid history and human history. That's the way we ate.
Yeah.
So I still advocate that kind of diet, not just for diabetes, although for diabetes it's remarkable because you can't make sugar, blood sugar, from fat. It's the one food you can use for satiety. And I've not seen, in my anecdotal experience of consulting with people, any evidence that the fat is causing any problem whatsoever. In fact, it people become very, if they don't eat sugar and starches, they become very lean. They become they're healthier. They feel like moving around more.
I'm the same way. I only saw positive things with that sort of diet. So that's the only dietary recommendation that I made, and it wasn't across the board. It was mostly just this. People that I thought would really benefit from that. I did it myself for a while.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the way we both eat, so it works for us. What about all this jowl shaking about, you know, this about diabetes and heart disease? What is that?
Well, I think complications of diabetes is a more accelerated form of atherosclerosis. So that's the connection.
So you have this glycation end product thing that's going on, and that's hardening their arteries a bit.
Well, there's something about the diabetic condition that seems to correlate with increased atherosclerosis. Again, it's not a 1-to-1 or 100% thing, but there's certainly a tendency there. Some sort of connection. I don't really understand it completely. I don't know. I never really read a satisfactory explanation of it.
Are you? It sounds like you're on a cordless phone, and you might be moving away from your base a little bit. You're getting a little distorted there, just a bit.
Oh,
just a
no,
tad.
I'm.
You're still sitting by it. Okay.
I'm still by it, but
okay.
Occasionally
your
the
battery.
Occasionally, the lower end of the phone wanders away from my mouth a little bit.
Okay. So in your experience of this long, was 30-year practice. What did you note, what things do you think contributed to people aging in a healthier way? What sort of things really seemed to be positive for people? You were not doing risk factor medicine. What things did you see that really contributed to people having an active and comfortable aging experience?
I don't know.
No! Nothing consistent? It was completely individual?
I didn't really think much about it. my view of the doctor's role, it might be a little different than many others, in that I view the doctor's role as diagnosing and recommending treatment for disease. And there's not much that I know of to recommend to people to prevent disease. In order to prevent something, you have to know what causes it. And we're pretty deficient in that area.
Oh, yes.
For most of the serious diseases we're looking mm-hmm. at.
Yeah, the whole clotting thing is one area where we don't know.
Right. A lot of possibilities there, but yeah. We just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, our perspective is that orthomolecular medicine, using nutrients targeted correctly and balancing them and using them that way, I mean, the history of using them goes back to before they started developing pharmaceuticals, and there's very simple nutrients can be very, I mean, for instance, with hypertension, taking some extra magnesium at bedtime is very important because it's a vasodilator. It opens up the venous blood flow, so you lower your blood pressure. And magnesium, unlike drugs, is and it's a calcium blocker because it's an agonist to calcium. So you get, but if you take too much, you don't lose your brain function and have your muscles crumble. You just get gassy and get a case of diarrhea because it's too much. And then you know, okay, let's take a day off or two and then cut back to a lower dose. And there are many things that work in that way. There are many, many heart protective things that help the muscle to be strong and to increase the capacity of the mitochondria and the muscles and stuff, which is like CoQ10. And one thing that I've noticed in research that I've done for shows that I've done that is that almost inevitably all the pharmaceuticals that are used for a particular condition knock out the vital nutrients or the vital nutrient pathways for the very things that would protect you from having that. Like vitamin K, for instance, all the blood thinners are vitamin K agonists. They destroy your vitamin K, so they tell you don't even eat leafy greens. And vitamin K isn't something that's pro-clotting. Vitamin K is something that mediates clotting and makes the vessel wall stronger, so it actually prevents ruptures for the most part.
It may well. I don't know.
Yeah. Jeffrey, do you have anything that you want to ask Dr. Curtis? You're just sitting here taking it all in. He thinks it's...
You sat there patiently this entire time?
Yeah, not a thing. You don't want to add something? No. He said, we're in the middle of a big project of building a house, so it's... Anyway. So, what can I say? I agree with everything that you've said. It is interesting how tenacious... What is... You know, some people just immediately go, well, this is all economic. But as I said, I think it's also fear-based. And also I think it's the problem with this idea of MD not meaning minor deity. So it's hard to sort of climb down from the throne and say you don't know, which is what you're doing. And yeah. So this stuff persists. Is there any other reasons that you can think of why this is so tenacious, why they won't let go of this cholesterol
stuff? Yeah,
in fact,
I did a whole chapter on that.
Yeah. Oops, we're getting very garbled. We're getting a little garbled.
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit here, too.
Okay, try it again.
Yes, as I said, I did a whole chapter on that. Why is this hanging in there so much in face of all the evidence against it? And talked about all of the incentives facing the different groups of people and why they would perpetuate it, in particular when looking at my own group, the medical profession. I stated that I think one major reason was that doctors don't want to lose credibility
mm-hmm.
when they've been telling their patients for 20 years to do this or do that, all of a sudden turn around and say, "Gee, I guess I was wrong. I'm sorry, I misled you for 20 years." They would rather keep up the charade. Assuming they even know it's a charade.
Well, and they don't want to get sued and things like that.
Yeah, they're a little bit cowed by that, too, and that's where all these guidelines and things come into play. And
well,
that never really bothered me much. I just told my patients to ignore all of that. No one ever sued me.
No, I get it. Well, you know, we are a culture of experts, and that is a big problem. it's a culture of celebrity and experts.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there a lot of old Eastern religions say to you, don't put someone else's experience over your own. Always listen to your own experience as a way to sort yourself through things, because it, you know, it changes, and we change, and the rules seem to change. And even if you sort of find a way to live that feels vital and healthy, it does shift and change as you age, and you have to reconsider and reform some of your techniques for being, yes, being engaged and healthy. I mean, we all know that exercise helps. We all know that keeping your blood sugars down, even if you're not diabetic, helps. I think that there, I noticed that, I think you made some quick comment in the book about this, but I do believe the studies I'm seeing about exposure to non-ionizing radiation as a cause for a number of different symptoms, and I think that is causing people to have hyperarousal symptoms, and many people are reporting heart symptoms as a result of exposure to Wi-Fi routers and smart meters and using their cell phone too much and stuff. So again, you have to sort of experiment, use your body as a lab, and see what helps and hurts you as an individual.
I don't think I mentioned anything about
electromagnetic
waves in my book.
Maybe. No, but you said, you made a comment about correlative studies, you know, and said like cell phones cause brain cancer, and now I think we pretty much know that they do. So sometimes studies are helpful because you've got a non-consenting group of people who are being experimented on without permission.
Well, I would also point out that those sorts of studies, those are all epidemiological, and they prove nothing. They may suggest areas of interest to look into, but by themselves, they prove nothing.
Okay. I wonder what you do to promote health in yourself. Are you an active person? Do you find exercise helps you?
I certainly helps me feel better.
Yeah.
I like to play tennis. I like to play competitive tennis. And I'm 68 years old now, so I find that in the third set, I'm pretty bushed.
Yeah.
And if I go out and do some regular walking, that's the only exercise I do, and just take a nice brisk walk.
Mm-hmm.
Regularly, I feel better. I have more energy and last longer on the tennis court.
Yeah, well, I think the old use it or lose it thing does matter. It's just a question of pacing to what you actually feel good doing.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the challenges.
Right. And it's a trade-off, you know, because to exercise per se isn't always fun. So you have to trade that off against the better feeling you're going to get when you are in shape. And I go back and forth. I go in and out of shape.
Okay. Well,
I know what I have to do
when you get out. Ernest N. Curtis, MD, The Cholesterol Delusion, I want to thank you for your willingness to spend this time with us on the phone.
It's been a pleasure.
I really appreciate your work, and thank you again.
Yeah, and I have many happy memories of Berkeley.
Oh, yeah. We're
actually
heard all over the country. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Curtis.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our archive shows with our library card feature. Find out about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to contact us, please do it by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.